This is Coast to Coast AM with guest host Barbara Simpson. To talk to Barbara, call the wildcard line at 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To call Barbara toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach Barbara by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
Good morning. We're talking with Charles Ostman on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson, in for Art Bell. And just this whole subject is so incredibly fascinating when we're talking about this new technology where everything gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And we didn't really even get into the whole area of using the technology in terms of medicine, but I'm sure you've heard of the surgery that can be done where they actually send, you can swallow something that's like a little camera, and it can take pictures of your insides. We're not talking about x-rays now. We're talking about something inside of you. The microsurgery that is able to be done. I interviewed a doctor who did surgery on babies in the womb way before they're born, several months before they're born, correcting birth defects so that when the child is born, it's healthy. It's absolutely phenomenal. And one question I want to ask Charles Ostman when we get back as well is the whole issue of privacy. With all of this wonderful technology and everything that will be known about us and done to us and for us, will we lose our privacy, or have we? I think in many ways we probably already lost it. But what does that mean to us as human beings? Because that's the other part of it. And he mentioned the spiritual aspect. We'll touch on that too. And of course, take your questions because we have open lines this hour. So give us a call right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson. Charles Ostman, before the end of the last hour, you were talking about a court case in which they were able, see if I got this right, they were able to determine that the person had not committed the murder by analyzing what in his brain? Charles.
We store a holographic record of all of our experiences. Everything that we've ever experienced from the moment we were born, perhaps even before we were born, not sure about that, but certainly we've gotten to the point where we can measure and, in a sense, codify this information and translate it into electrical signals, which can then be interpreted to represent what those experiences were. So in the case of the murder trial, the person in question had been accused of shooting somebody or stabbing, I forget which now, but the point was there was a car and a street, and a scene where the body was, like, laying on the sidewalk and so on. And he was able to successfully demonstrate in court that this person had never seen these circumstances or had participated in the process where these circumstances occur because the signature was not there in his brain.
That's amazing. But if that really works, why don't they use that for every single trial?
Well, there's a lot of people looking at this, and but again, I'm not one trained in the art form of you know, criminal law. I have a little bit of law background, but some patents, really. So, I mean, the process that it might take to get it universally accepted in all the courts in every state—that's a whole separate kind of political issue, which I'm not sure I'm qualified to offer an opinion on. But certainly, the enterprise of being able to interpret signals from the brain and then utilize these signals to either control something or interact with something or, in a sense, to show that the brain has had a given experience, this has been done for years. We're just now on the edge of being able to refine it to a much more precise process.
Wow.
By the way, if you remember, there was a film that came out a number of years ago with Clint Eastwood. I think it was called Firefox, where he stole this Russian high-tech plane, and in the process of stealing the plane, he had to think in Russian because of the mind link that was connected between his brain and the plane. Now, as it turns out, this, in fact, was based partly in reality. As far back as the early 90s at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, there were experiments using squid detectors to allow a pilot to sync commands to a control system, left, right, up, down, you know, and various numerical values, that kind of thing. Now, at the time, the technology was still kind of crude, and in fact, I saw a photograph of a pilot volunteer, quote-unquote, strapped into a gurney with this gigantic piece of machinery about the size of a 55-gallon drum sort of suspended over his head. Now, obviously, that's not going to fit into a cockpit.
No.
But the basic purpose of it was, and even back then it was realized, that the performance of the aircraft was far exceeding the pilot's capacity to deal with the G-forces that he would have to experience. And the theory was that they could shorten the time between cognizing the information on the panel and looking out the window and getting all the information that's required and then actually executing a response, the number of milliseconds it took to get from first cognition to actual response, if that could be shortened a little bit by a direct mind link, that would buy an extra half a G-force or perhaps more of performance. That was the basic theory of that. Now, since that time, the enterprise of translating thought into actual action has become so, I don't want to say roach, but so sort of ordinary, that at the Next Fest event that was just here in San Francisco I was talking about a couple weeks ago, there was actually a game as a kind of an entertainment called Brain Ball. I'm not kidding. And the idea was that two people could sit down and strap on this EEG interface, and they could push a ball back and forth across a little board by their thoughts. And then you would actually see their brain waves demonstrated on two screens overhead. And it was mostly kids, you know, high school kids and the like, and they were having fun and kind of having a good time at it. But the whole idea was they were using your thought to push a ball back and forth on a table as an entertainment. That's how far this has come.
Isn't that the technology that they're working on for people who are quadriplegics?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the positive side. I completely support the concept that, you know, I talk in my spiritual world, I talk a lot about us living beings sort of confined to this contraption we call a body as a sort of a temporary place to reside, and it's a separate topic maybe. But for many people who are limited by the physical equipment they have, and I happen to be rather severely sight impaired myself, so I have my own, you know, thoughts about this. But for many people, the fact that they can be liberated from that confinement and have, whether it's sensory or sight or ambulatory or whatever the process is that can be neurologically corrected for, this is a wonderful example of how this technology really can be used in a very positive way.
Is that also related? I remember an interview I did on Coast a while back with a writer who did research in the area of helping the blind to see by the implant that goes in the head.
It's an artificial retina, and there's several different programs, all of which are aimed at the enterprise of restoring sight by an implant that actually goes into the eye itself.
That's right.
And then in some cases, they're also able to amplify the signal once it goes into the optic nerve. Interestingly enough, the optic nerve goes across the celestial meridian of the brain. It's actually in the back of the brain where the information is processed. But the eye itself is a kind of a miniature brain. The fovea of the eye sort of does a kind of a processing before the signal eventually gets to where the brain is. And that whole mechanism is where a lot of the difficulty occurs, because the interconnects between the fovea and a sort of circuitry behind it, that gets scrambled or in some cases affected because of birth defects and so on. And that's where the real interest is, because if we can restore that, that's like solving 90% of the problem.
That was a cover story on Wired magazine, and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I'm just in total awe of what can be done. Obviously, with a little bit of concern about if it gets in the wrong hands, but it's just amazing how it can improve our lives. We have a number of people on the line, Charles, who want to talk with you, so let's get some calls in. We have Steve is calling us on the east of the Rockies line. Steve, you're on Coast to Coast AM. Where are you calling from?
Chattanooga, Tennessee. Listen to you on WGOW out here.
Terrific. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question. My background is electronics, and I've been trying to grasp what some of the doctors have been saying here. What does he foresee? I know there's troubles now with successive die shrinks as far as, you know, the miniaturization of components that we have now and the actual ion implantation systems that they use to, you know, deposit substrates on these new chips that they're using. And the fact that also the way gravity affects growing the silicon crystals here on Earth, does he see this something as something that's not going to really get in depth until we move into space, to where we can actually have facilities free from gravity, and, you know, to where we can pick this technology up and run with it, like, you know, I'm hoping that they are able to do. And what time frame are we looking at here? And, you know, what does he foresee, you know, the medical applications of some of this stuff as?
Okay, a couple of different questions, and they sort of branch in different directions, but I'll try to address these as best I can. In the world of zero gravity, actually, the best application for it right now is to grow crystallized proteins, and that's a whole world in of itself. Crystallized proteins have extraordinary medical potential, but they're extremely hard to produce on Earth. In zero gravity, though, they form up quite beautifully, and there's a whole range of medical applications, which I won't go into right now because it would take too long. But let me address the first question, which has to do with Moore's Law, which is, I think, what you're asking about. Now, I have a lot of friends in the semiconductor business, and that's kind of my background as well. And I'll tell you this, that, okay, right now, just to give you some numbers, the state-of-the-art is 95-nanometer junctions on a 400-millimeter-wide wafer, and that's like pushing the extreme edge of the science. There are some research activities, like at the Albany facility in Albany, New York, where they're trying to go for 50 nanometers and maybe even 35 nanometers on, you know, 600-millimeter wafers. But the problem is the cost of creating those kinds of fabrication sites would be tens of billions of dollars. And if you work the numbers to amortize the cost of how many devices you would have to sell to justify the loss leader investment of that kind of fab system, the numbers simply don't work. So there's something called Moore's Second Law, which in fact I think will interfere long before the rules of physics gets in the way. So I'd like to turn your attention to a different kind of potential solution. And that is to, in a sense, instead of having to etch into slabs of silicon using top-down fabrication, let's leave the silicon CMOS fabrication process as it currently is, but instead begin to work with molecular systems that can be sort of grown or assembled on top of the silicon, kind of like the silicon being like a circuit board or a backplane for these much smaller systems. And now to get to that process, for instance, people are looking at how to use living organisms or proteomics to move other materials around as a kind of a self-assembly process. In fact, there's a very famous scientist by the name of Angela Belcher, a wonderful woman, one of the brightest people I've ever met in my life, who really pioneered this concept. She actually started a company called Senzyme, which just got funded last year. She's originally from Texas A&M, and now she's at MIT. And she's one of, you know, several major players in this arena, but you're going to see a lot more of this in the near future, where the concept is to use either a viral-like entity that can be genetically modified to carry metals around with it on a surface. I'm not kidding. This is actually being done, so you can
Good
sort of
heavens.
Grow a circuit literally on a Petri dish. Or, in some cases, people are using DNA, literally, as a kind of a coding system, because, as you probably know, the protein pairs in DNA only link up in a certain fashion, so that if one can control the patterning of the protein sets in the DNA, you can then build complex structures with the DNA. And in fact, that process is called structural proteomics. And in fact, Ned Seaman at New York State University sort of pioneered this process several years ago, but now you have a whole bunch of people all over the country who are beginning to use DNA as a way to move other materials around to create molecular-scale circuits that can literally be grown or self-assembled in a very fast and easy way. So the theory is, rather than discard the current silicon CMOS infrastructure, which is many, many billions of dollars, and nobody wants to see that just tossed away unnecessarily, but simply keep the technology as it is, but use as a supporting mechanism or a platform upon which other new molecular systems can be then implemented.
So this new molecular system that you're talking about doesn't have any fallbacks or where the gravity issue is concerned?
It's not really gravity dependent, at least not to the best of my knowledge. I've seen plenty of examples where it can be done simply in a room using very ordinary tabletop equipment. But again, the area where the space and, you know, zero gravity would be truly useful would be in the crystallized proteins, and they do have spectacular medical potential for that.
That's amazing. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that call. And the time factor is some of that is already taking place.
Some of it's already taking place, and I would say realistically, to get any major industry to go to the kind of paradigm shift where they would have to adopt a new manufacturing system, go through all the beta tests and all the long-term analysis and so forth, it's probably going to be 5, 7, maybe 10 years out before you start seeing it, you know, in your neighborhood computer store or something like this. But, I mean, certainly the beginning edge of this infrastructure is being developed as we speak.
It sure is. Let's go to the West of the Rockies line. Nathan is there. Hi, Nathan. You're on Coast to Coast AM. Where are you calling from?
I am calling from fabulous Las Vegas.
Las Vegas. All right.
City of Lights.
Sure is.
I'm going to apologize in advance if I get cut off. I'm on a cell phone. So,
okay.
Charles, you kind of answered my two-parter question here in advance before the previous caller. And my questions are, does bio or nanotechnology in later evolution pave the way for bio-augmentation such as light enhancement vision for military application? And the second part of that question is, if you class this technology with quantum computing, where do you see this going as sort of a pick-your-brain sort of a thing?
These are two excellent questions, and these are two areas that I actually specifically am working on as we speak. So
really?
I'll answer the best I can.
Okay.
Certainly in the context of enhanced human performance, there's something called the Super Soldier Project, which is actually undergoing right now at MIT, being financed by DARPA. And some areas of it I really can't talk about, but I can just say generally that there's an extreme interest in trying to expand the sensory capacity, the endurance, and ability to survive certain kinds of toxic traumas, that kind of thing. Right now, the big push is to go for exoskeleton, for sort of smart armor, things, you know, self-healing, sort of intelligent fabrics, that kind of thing. But they're very quickly looking at also how to enhance the human body itself, and precisely with these areas, sensory capacity being the first target. But then, to answer your second question, in the quantum computing world, this is like the ultimate sort of holy grail. If we ever get that far, it would blow the lid off of computing as we currently know it to be in such a way it would be almost, it would be hard to describe in terms. However, this is a very tough nut to crack. In the meantime, though, I'll give you a couple of quick examples of what is occurring as we speak. Now, some people are claiming they've gotten as far as 5 qubits, and for those that know what that means something, but it would take too long to explain this. But at Los Alamos, they do actually have a program where they've gotten close to the 5-qubit mark. But in the meantime, quantum encryption is actually happening as we speak. In fact, there's already a company called Magic Technologies. They're on the East Coast, and they spoke at one. I chair a series of conferences every year, and they spoke at my conference last year. And you can, if you wish to, spend the money, buy a box, and inside the box you'll have a bunch of fiber optic cable and an optics maze. And essentially what happens is, and you probably know about this, but there was an experiment that happened in Zurich some years ago to prove quantum entanglement. And what that meant was they took a photon, split it in half, and put the two halves of the photons down opposing pieces of fiber optic cable, and then they bent or twisted one of the photon halves, and the other half bent at the same time. So this proved that there was quantum entanglement, even though the photons were separated by miles of cable. So based on that general theory, some very clever folks came up with some very interesting schemes for encryption using this kind of quantum photonic entanglement as a way to encode information in light. And you can now buy a system for a few $1,000s where you can have your own quantum encryption system for your own purposes. Now, of course, obviously the military is very big on this idea, and I think we'll see more of this popping up commercially in the years to come. Realistically, is a quantum computer in our future anywhere near? Probably 7, maybe 10 years off, because the physics of having to create a system that can reliably produce the quantum effects we're looking for, we're on the edge of having the materials available to sort of make this feasible, but it's still very much a research area.
That is amazing. What great questions, Nathan. Thanks for doing that. That was great. Let's go to Mark on the first-time caller line. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Listen, my question involves...
Need you to speak up so we can hear you.
Yeah, my question essentially, it involves, you know, with the expansion of knowledge that the doctor is referring to, how do you believe that this is actually going to expand our understanding of a higher intelligent designer? I think that, and this is just my personal opinion, that as we slowly embark on certain areas, it is becoming highly likely for any rationalist to view that this is not just some fortuitous happening taking place, but that there is some sort of intelligent design behind our knowledge.
Actually, I agree with you. In fact, a lot of the cosmologists and people I know is sort of in the astrophysics world, as they explore the universe ever more, they become ever more convinced there's something far beyond just a bunch of random happenings. And the same thing happens at the nanoscale. We are ever more surprised at how astonishing this design strategy really is.
Okay, hold your thought, only because we're out of time for this half hour. Thank you for that question. We'll continue with that. Your calls, my guest, Charles Ostman. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast to Coast AM. This is the sound. I bought a ticket to the world. But now I've come back again. Why do I find it hard to write the next line?
Coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with guest host Barbara Simpson. To talk to Barbara, call the wildcard line at 818-501-4109. The first time caller line is 818-501-4721. To call Barbara toll free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach Barbara by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. And now, filling in for Art Bell, here is Barbara Simpson.
You are probably asking yourself how high gas prices will go this summer. You might even be wondering how high they'll be 10 years from now. They're pretty high now. According to the June issue of the After Dark newsletter, the era of cheap oil is over. You can find out why and what we can do about it. Also, you're going to get part two of Art's interview with John Lear. You get George's editorial about MRIs. I know he's talked about that on the air. Some pretty scary new surveillance technology being developed, and our webmaster's Lex Lonehood's monthly oddities column is only available through After Dark. You can subscribe now, and you will still get that special gift of the free Malachi Martin CD, but that ends for certain on June 18th. And I am told that date is cast in stone, June 18th. That's it. So get your order in now. Don't miss out. Call right now, 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505, or sign up online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server. There it is. Or just call the number, 1-888-727-5505. We'll be right back. We're talking with Charles Ostman. Charles, just one quick follow-up on the last thing you were talking about at the end of the bottom of the hour. Does that mean then that, you know, as we learn more, as things get smaller and smaller and bigger, that the people involved in it are, in fact, perhaps admitting that there is a creator of all of this, a god, if you will?
This is a kind of a tricky subject to work with, but I will offer you the following thing, that a lot of the science people I talk to, as they probe further and further into these realms where complexity becomes ever more apparent, there is an overwhelming sense that something much more intelligent than us had to have come up with some kind of a design strategy to make this all possible. Whether it's confined to the traditional, quote-unquote, vision of a single god, or whether it's I tend to believe that we're like part of an evolutionary ladder of sorts, and we're kind of low at the bottom, really. There are many other stages that translate into different forms of being. Now, my personal theory is that maybe at some top of the evolutionary food chain, there's more like a quantum being. And in fact, a number of people have written about this far better than I can articulate right now. In fact, an organization called the Foundation for Mind Being Research, and one of them is founders of something, a guy by the name of Dr. Goff, who, in fact, I gave a talk to last year, and he wrote a paper on this concept and talked about the seven stages of evolution, where at the very bottom you have sort of the dense matter beings, at the very top you have the quantum beings and the different stages in between. The quantum being, as I would call it, are beings that they have no physical body at all. A physical manifestation is just a complete arbitrary process. But they have a sort of holographic, metascale-like existence where they really are able to manifest extraordinary interaction at energy levels to really affect the makings of the universe or its configuration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just one theoretical view. Oddly enough, Star Trek even sort of attempted to suggest this when they had the so-called Q character, and I think that was their way of articulating this in a Hollywood setting. But clearly, we're just a very small, little, tiny sort of a grain of sand in the beach of existence, as it were. And again, I don't know if there's a single god or a god species or something like this, but I'm certainly open to suggest that there are other levels of existence far beyond our current status, and that we, as an entity, are kind of required in a way to graduate to ever wiser, sort of broader sense of how we fit into that framework as we attempt to negotiate our way through this evolutionary process.
Wisdom is the most difficult part of it.
it's probably the ultimate prize that we could hope to attain in the current form of existence that we're aware of.
Yeah,
that is the challenge that we're faced with. And I think ever more than in the past, we need to try to adapt to understanding how we can work with the wisdom that might be potentially within our reach.
What was that song, What's It All About, Alfie? That's really kind of what we're doing. Let's go to the international line. Justin is there. Hi, Justin. You're on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead.
Hi there, Barbara. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Where are you, Justin?
I'm calling from Oakville, Ontario, Canada.
Thank you. Go ahead.
This is a really exciting show tonight.
Thank you.
I kind of consider myself a layman when it comes to science and technology, but a lot of this really makes sense to me. A lot of my friends will look at me like I'm crazy when I try to rationalize ideas that are outlined in, you know, movies like The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
But, the way I look at it, 50 years ago, you know, the army in the field was using radios, you know, or glorified telephones the size of a backpack. And now we have, you know, cell phones that fit in the palm of our hand and like AM, FM radios that are the size of an earphone. So, I mean, how long is it until that technology, you know, can either be implanted or grown inside our bodies? And then before you know it, we'll be shopping with the thought and like trading stock with the thought and, you know, even communicating with my next door neighbor or, you know, my friend on vacation just with a thought, almost like a telepath.
Well, actually, it's funny you bring that up because that was going to be the last part of the program that I wanted to segue into. So thank you once again for being so intuitive, keyword being intuitive, because I feel, and I'm just going to try to explain this briefly, that there's an enormous amount of research which has been sort of quietly ongoing for a number of years. We're beginning to look into just what really happens with empathic interaction. And I know that Art has talked about this in the past, and he even did some experiments in the program where he had lots of people concentrate on, like, rain, for instance, and suddenly rain would appear.
Exactly.
And in fact, I had a friend in Florida where they were having a drought on the very night that he did one of those experiments, and millions of people, I guess, thought about rain, and presto, rain really appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a more practical sense, here at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, right near where I live, a very wonderful woman named Elizabeth Targ, who recently died, I'm sorry to say, but she was a medical doctor who spent many years researching the actual effects of prayer or focused intentionality on patients who are suffering from AIDS and cancer and all kinds of things, with about a 70% of some kind of effect, whatever it was, changing the status of their health. And this was done with third-party review, blind study, placebo. Every kind of traditional method that we use in scientific research was applied in this context.
Do you know Dr. Larry Dossey?
I've heard the name, but I've never, you know, spoken to him personally.
Yeah, he's done research in this area. I've interviewed him on Coast, and he's done research in this area, too. Apparently, they did a study at San Francisco General Hospital with heart patients and found it very successful.
Absolutely. And so there's a lot to be said for this. And if I may just very briefly suggest something, if you go back in time to virtually every indigenous culture that's ever existed on this planet, with very few exceptions, regardless of race or social system or geographic part of the planet they come from, three extremely consistent tenets sort of pop up. If you strip away the surface veneer of ritual and language, these are extremely consistent. And it would be that, A, all living things are somehow interconnected through some seemingly invisible but very tangible way, that, B, life extends beyond this contraption we call a body, and, C, for the most part, certainly in North American culture, the surrounding land or the planet or the sort of environment we live in is a part of a larger living system. Now, one could say it's just a bunch of philosophical hoopla, but in fact, I would suggest that, anecdotally at least, it's such an overwhelming consistency does kind of suggest there might be some truth to this. Okay, now we fast forward to the current day. Again, with nanotechnology being what it is, we're beginning to examine what happens at the molecular, even submolecular level from a quantum interaction perspective. Now, a lot of folks are beginning to tap into the specific business of what really happens if there is, in fact, a quantum interaction between neurological processes and a quantum perturbation, an entanglement, if you will, that would mathematically at least explain why empathic interaction really works and why things like remote influencing, perhaps remote viewing and so forth, actually might really occur. It turns out that Roger Penrose, who won the Nobel Prize in Mathematics, mind you, speculated on some of this many, many years ago. In more recent times, he, like Stuart Hameroff, the University of Arizona, have spent quite a bit of time and some really good research in beginning to develop physical models for how this process really works. And you might know about Roger Nelson, of course, from Princeton, who has this project called the Global Consciousness Project.
Right.
Actually measure the correlation between mass events, tragedies, sporting events, 9/11 being the largest ever measured, by the way, and the effect that it has on random number generation. The reason being that randomness is a very fragile mathematical state, and so if there was a way to sort of indicate at least the potential of a quantum perturbation affecting a physical system, that would be a very obvious one. And sure enough, about 80% of the time, there's a direct correlation between these mass events and the system. There's about 40 of these RNGs that are tied together on a global network. So we have at least the rough tools to kind of quantitatively examine the potential for how this process works. I'm suggesting that we're kind of approaching the edge, again, from a nanotechnology perspective, to qualitatively begin to analyze how this process works. Now, what does this really mean? What would be the consequence, for instance, if we really could tap into this sort of n-dimensional quantum interaction realm where it was not necessarily confined by spiritual philosophy or certain kinds of training, let's say, that took many, many years to perfect, but something could be sort of tapped into, almost the way you would tap into the Internet now, what kind of power could that possibly represent? I think this is something that, in fact, will happen if we get that far. In other words, we're sort of on the very rough edge of getting a glimpse of what this might really look like. Let's say 25 or 30 years from now, we really could use our collective consciousness to drive, to physically affect the manifold that we're all encased in or part of. The purpose for this, in my way of looking at this, would be to affect change on a global scale that goes outside the boundaries of traditional political or social processes. And I think that, in fact, is what we're being sort of trained to get towards now.
You know, just sort of taking that and jumping into what you could do with, a science fiction type book, if you had an individual who was able to master that power, that person could rule the earth.
Well, instead of confined to one person, I'm going to go the other direction. I would like to suggest, and this one I've been kind of quietly working on, but I guess I'll publicly talk about it now.
Okay.
Sort of picking up where Roger Nelson leaves off. And by the way, I've talked to Roger, a wonderful person. I've talked to his son also, by the way, who works with him as his partner in his project. Very, very good scientist, very down to earth. He's very practical. He's done the very best that any scientist probably could do to kind of get at the edge of saying, okay, we know these phenomena exist, we're not sure how they work, but at least we can measure this part of the process. It's excellent work, and I really advise anyone who wants to look at it, they should have a second look. But picking where that leaves off, we're about, I think, in my opinion, to have tools to really look at what happens at this interface between intentionality and the effect it has on biological systems. And by that I mean not just living organisms, but also systems that behave biologically. And by this I mean, since we're going to go back to the infotech we were talking about a while ago, imagine now that we have this global network of all these different computing systems and platforms which are behaving ever more biologically, that we're sort of connected to, you know, through this kind of human interface with the network systems as a kind of a collaborative organization of sorts. Let's just presuppose for a moment that collective consciousness could be harnessed and harvested as a way to influence change that would affect global economies, sort of global resources as they're being pushed around and sort of manipulated by forces that are outside our direct control, but in fact might be in fact well within our control, but only through the mechanism of a collective intentionality. I don't see it as being one person becoming the super individual that then rules the world. I see it as the exact opposite. I see it as the sort of ultimate direct form of group participation to affect our global existence patterns based on the intentionality that we can bring to bear through this process.
Which means you're the optimist and I'm the pessimist.
And somewhere between the two extremes may probably be the outcome. But again, that's the next evolutionary challenge that we're about to start having a look at.
Let's squeeze another call in. Wildcard line. Ryan, where are you calling from, Ryan? And quick question for our guest, please.
Yes, I'm calling from Denver. And,
okay.
My question is this. How close do you suppose we are to developing a nanotechnology that can identify and annihilate pathological cells?
Well, you're right on the very cusp of one of these military things that I'm probably only going to say a little bit about. But here's a kind of a nutshell. The big fear right now, and by the way, to give a bit of background, I had the interesting experience of having about 4 hours of Dr. Ken Allebeck's time.
Mm.
Dr. Ken Allebeck, as I'm sure Barbara knows, he was the supreme director of all biowarfare development for the Soviet Union and defected in 1994.
Right.
He answered directly to Gorbachev, in fact, wrote a book called Biohazard, which is, if you want to read a scary book, believe me, there's a book to read.
I have it, and I've interviewed him, and he's frightening and wonderful at the same time.
He's a very brilliant man, and I think very sincere about what he feels, but he's also a person to understand in the world of his familiar. He is the sort of portal to get at this realm of information. But here's the point I'm trying to get at. The big fear right now is not known organisms. We can kind of deal with, or we can actually detect organisms from a distance by using laser light, and then there's a process I won't go into. We can kind of measure the absorption lines of different biological materials. So in that context, we can measure even from a great distance if there are certain kinds of bugs in the air or proteomic signatures that represent something unpleasant. And then we can develop antidotes to neutralize these. The problem is that in today's world, with recombinant proteomics being the way it is, the big fear is hybrid organisms, these things that are sort of brewed up to have special characteristics. I mean, for instance, theoretically, imagine a hypervirulent Hunter virus hemorrhagic fever that could be spread through the air through some kind of aerosol delivery system, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and has maybe genetically selective properties. You know, whatever. I'm just making something up out of thin air. But, I mean, that's the kind of stuff people are dreaming of.
Exactly.
The reality is, how close are we? It's probably pretty close. And so how can we deal with anticipating yet encountered organisms that we only have a partial signature for? How quickly can we identify what they are and then figure out some way to neutralize them? That is, in fact, the exact cat-and-mouse game that's occurring as we speak. So a lot of the biodefense technology that's being brewed up, it may sound scary, but I think it's also kind of necessary because we are, in fact, going to have to be able to counteract these kinds of new biological threats, which, in fact, will occur. There's no doubt about it.
One quick question, and thank you, Ryan, for your call. One quick question I want to ask you before we run out of time. You mentioned before about proteins. Would it be possible, using some of this technology you're talking about, for us to destroy the prion, which causes mad cow disease?
Interesting you should mention that, because one of the companies I'm actually working with and helping to raise funds for, et cetera, has developed a detection process that can detect including prions, by the way, in food. And this is a big, big deal, not just because of biowarfare, but just because of basic economic concerns, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Sure.
I mean, the problem that Britain went through was kind of a wake-up call. It was kind of like the Y2K of the biology world. But it certainly brought to bear a whole new area of nanobiology that simply wasn't known before. And there's a whole host of these kinds of prion-like entities. They're not even whole organisms. They're like partial organisms. And they kind of lie in wait until they hook up with the right protein mesh, and then they suddenly become this living thing. And what's interesting about these critters is they can live dormant for incredible lengths of time, even in your own body, before all of a sudden they come to life and spring all kinds of horrible results.
And they're almost indestructible, too.
And they're almost, and that's the whole point. These things can survive radiation, being boiled. I mean, it's unbelievable. You try to kill these things. In fact, one last thing, because I know we're almost off the air.
Just about.
There's an area of what's called astrobiology. In fact, a very nice fellow who's been a great guest, by the way, his name is Jonathan Trent. He's right here at NASA Ames. He's part of this group of folks who researches essentially where life can exist where we wouldn't expect to find it. And in fact, getting back to what we were talking about a little while ago, biology being unpredictable, the whole point is that astrobiologists will go into deep sea trenches, they'll go into bubbling mud pits where it's 9 degrees Celsius with a pH of 2, they'll go into, you know, rocks at the bottom of caves that are half a mile down.
Charles, we're about out of time.
Oh, gosh. But I just wanted to say they keep finding life where they don't expect it. So it means that life really does proliferate in strange ways.
Astonishing. And everything you said is astonishing. I hope we can talk again. I've learned so much, and I know the audience has enjoyed it, too. Thank you so much, Charles Ostman. Thank you, everybody, to the whole crew at Premier, who make all of this possible. And, of course, all of you listening. I appreciate all your emails. Try to be good. And be careful what you pray for. You might get it. I'm Barbara Simpson.
How high will gas prices go this summer? How high will they be 10 years from now?